TFM.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. But, Matthew, you didn't know I was here yet, did you? I'm really sorry to sneak up on you like that, but, you know, I just had to test my new personal cloaking device.
Chris, how dare you? I don't like being scared. And two, I was wondering why there was a Romulan walking around.
Oh, you're talking about T'Rul? Yeah, I brought her with me. She only has one job, just to activate and deactivate the cloak.
Which is weird, because actually here she is also an engineer, apparently, as well.
Oh, so, yes, apparently
she doesn't
so.
Want engineering stuff. So apparently very familiar with the design of the Defiant, more so than just about anybody else.
It seems that way. So yes, everyone, we are talking about The Search, and today we're going to start a two-part series here on The Orb, where we talk about The Search, the beginning of Season 3 of DS9. And Matthew, as you rightly point out, that whole T'Rul thing, having her be there was kind of interesting to start with, that they've got this cloak from the Romulans, and there's this rule that they can only use it in the Gamma Quadrant, and also the Romulans apparently have so many people available that they can just send someone to sit on the Defiant and flip the on-off switch. But that moment that you mentioned there, where she announces that the engines are ready to go, I was thinking, isn't that Miles's job? Like, what's going on here? Or anyone other than T'Rul?
Yeah, that is one of the things here that is fascinating. But, you know, what's interesting is that by introducing her to the series, the idea of the cloaking device, and that the Romulans are willing to work with the Federation on certain things, really does set up a lot of what we're going to get for the rest of the series. I mean, you know, there's going to be huge Romulan incursion with the Tal Shiar and the Obsidian Order later on. And of course, you know, they'll become a part of the Dominion War. And so I do think that even though it's a weird thing and it's not something that lasts on the series, obviously, we don't see her very much after this. Mm-hmm. This two-part episode here, but what we do get is I think a seed planted for the fact that the Romulans are always looking at their best interests, and those align with the Federation, yeah, which makes for an interesting introduction for her. And I mean, you know, Chris, I guess I got to ask you too, because, and this isn't even on our outline, but it's just something I'm thinking. We introduced the idea of a Federation starship having a cloak here, which, you know, was something that was kind of anathema in Star Trek, that idea of, well, you know, Starfleet doesn't go sneaking around. How do you feel about that idea? I mean, obviously we're Niners and it becomes something just, mm-hmm, that's the Defiant. It has a cloaking device, but, and no other starship does in the end.
Right.
How did you feel about the introduction then? And is it something to which you just feel completely comfortable with now?
Well, to me, I don't know, that idea of the Federation doesn't go sneaking around is something that I never really was aligned with, I guess, because it doesn't make a lot of sense to me why you wouldn't have the cloak. Now, of course, a cloak can be used to sneak around, but a cloak can also be used to protect you so that you can complete scientific missions, for example, in dangerous areas. So it felt like it's this thing in Star Trek where the enemies have cloaks and then the Federation doesn't have... The Federation could build the technology if they wanted to, I'm sure, but they have this agreement that they will not deploy cloaking technology in their ships. And I think that was fine for Star Trek for a long time in terms of storytelling, but the idea that a group like Starfleet would deliberately cripple its ability to protect itself is something that I found to be odd, actually. And so I think it makes perfect sense that you would have a cloak here, especially on the Defiant, given the mission. The way that they figured out how to do it, because Rick Berman was opposed to the idea initially of having a cloak on the Defiant, but by putting some rules around it, only in the Gamma Quadrant, and also the story that was beginning to develop sort of necessitated having this advantage. And then, like you're saying here, it also gives the Federation an opportunity to work with the Romulans, and that's very Star Trek, of enemies finding a way to cooperate with each other. So I thought it was a nice addition to the show and a story element that was needed. And I think that more Starfleet ships should probably have cloaking devices.
Yeah, to me, I think it's something that really makes sense when you, like, what Sisko says about why they've been given the Defiant in the first place, why the Defiant was originally built, you know, the fact that it was meant to be basically a Borg killer, mm-hmm. with the threat of the Borg, and with the threat that they've come up against here with the Jem'Hadar, which is this genetically engineered race that is meant to be warriors and just to pummel you with numbers and destroy you wholesale if they need to.
And they are people who have personal cloaks as well, right?
Exactly.
They can cloak themselves more naturally,
exactly.
I guess.
So, yeah, I think this is something that makes a lot of sense as to why the Federation in Starfleet would okay this idea of using it in mm-hmm. the Gamma Quadrant to go on this mission. And it, I also think we see the fact that why the Defiant was originally built. And I think one of the things that it shows is that, you know, Starfleet, it is an exploratory organization, but it is also meant for the defense of the Federation.
Right.
And therefore, when you come up against enemies like the Borg, you do need specific type of weapons to fight somebody of that nature, especially when they have no desire for what the Federation does. They only wish to conquer, and that seems to be the same track mm-hmm. that the Dominion is on, and that's what this whole mission is about. So just introducing the Defiant and everything that goes along with it, and I think with the idea of the cloaking device, internally, I think the logic really makes a lot of sense here, mm-hmm. especially since all the simulations that we've been running on Deep Space Nine in this episode have Deep Space Nine being overrun within 2 hours.
Right.
You know,
well, imagine this, okay?
This is a dangerous situation.
Right. Well, imagine this. Imagine if Klingons and Romulans and Cardassians had quantum torpedoes, but the Federation said, you know, we think quantum torpedoes give us, they're too powerful. They give us some advantage that we feel we shouldn't have. So we're not going to develop quantum torpedoes in principle, but we're going to let our enemy have quantum torpedoes, but we're not going to do it. That wouldn't make any sense. And so I think cloaking technology is just another extension of a defensive capability. And also that whole debate that's gone on for years and years about, is Starfleet a science organization, you know, a scientific exploratory organization, or is it a military organization? I've always felt that it, by necessity, has to be both. And the cloak is an important part of that. So, okay, while we're talking about the Defiant, let's go ahead and talk about that part of our outline a little bit more, the introduction of the ship to the show in general, because there was often a feeling of, oh, finally, they're going to admit that it's a bad idea to have a show set on a space station where they can't go anywhere. So they're going to bring a ship in. Now they can fly anywhere they want. It can be more like Star Trek in the past. But that's not really the reason that the ship is introduced to the show. It comes in, as we're talking about, due to developments in the storyline. And it does also enable them to tell types of stories that they can't tell being only on the station, mm-hmm. while also not being any sort of admission that or feeling that they've hampered themselves in some way by the setting of the show. How do you feel about it?
I mean, I always loved the Defiant. I think it's a great little ship and it's a cool design. What I love is about how different it is from, you know, pretty much anything else that we had seen, which I think is phenomenal. And yet it still feels very Star Trek in its design. I think the idea of, again, you know, why it's created makes 100% sense, which I love. And, you know, I think what's also cool is that they tie it into the connection with Sisko himself. You know, Sisko was involved with the creation of the Defiant mm-hmm. in the first place when he was working at Utopia Planitia. And I really appreciate all of that thought that they put into this. And so, yes, it does give them the opportunity to do some different stories that you couldn't just do with a runabout. But most of the stories you can do with a runabout. And so I think I like that this feels so organic. And in many ways, it feels more organic than when they were kind of forced to put Worf on the show in season 4, even though that works out amazingly, and I'm not complaining about it. This does feel much more organic, and it does feel like this was something that to which they were actually leading to, because, mm-hmm. you know, the end of season 2, the way it ends with the Jem'Hadar and then into this, this all feels like it flows very logically, especially with the way they had been even building up the idea of the Gamma Quadrant and planting the seeds about the Dominion all the way back to where Quark was looking to buy the Tulaberry wine. So, I mean, there's just lots of seeds that have been planted here, and now they're really starting to bloom, and it's working. And so, yeah, I love the Defiant. 100% love it. It's one of my favorite Star Trek ships, and just was a great addition to the show and all. And I think its difference in the type of ship it is, too, just fit Deep Space Nine anyway. You know, it became known as the quote-unquote redheaded stepchild of Star Trek, which, no offense to anyone who's redheaded, I love redheads. So, but I think it being kind of like an oddball in starship design anyway just really fit with this kind of oddball Star Trek show, which became something that we love so much.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. And I wish that after this, that in Quark's bar, we could hear future Elton John singing Tulaberry Wine, playing as people are drinking. every time I watch this and I hear them talk about Tulaberry Wine, I always think of Elton John's Elderberry Wine. But that's it's a great way to describe the ship, though, what you're saying. And, you know, imagine they wouldn't have been able to tell the story that made DS9 the series that so many of us fell in love with if they didn't introduce mm-hmm. the Defiant, if they didn't ramp up the threat. And as Ira said about this, they were adding these threats to the show, and they had 3 runabouts to protect the station. And so you wouldn't be able to continue to build the story if you tried to keep everything limited to the runabouts that you originally had and you didn't ramp things up with a ship like the Defiant. And like you said, it felt very natural. I remember watching it the first time and the ship shows up and I didn't have any feeling like, oh, they're going to add a ship to the show. It felt like the way season 2 ended, being a good commander, Sisko realized, you know, we're going to need some more firepower. We're going to need some mobility. Let's go to Starfleet and see what we can work out and then come back with the ship. And so it felt like a very natural evolution of the story to me.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about the overall shift in tone of the series then, because this is part of it, bringing the ship here. But there are a lot of other elements that shift here. One of them that you and I were talking about on the other side of the orb is this feeling of family. And finally, Sisko and Jake are feeling at home on the station.
Mm-hmm. No, I completely love this part of the show. And I love the way in which we do allow Sisko to finally feel some permanence in this place. You know, the whole show, of course, started with him being uncomfortable with being here in the first place. He did not want this assignment.
Right.
And in many ways, he didn't even know how to move forward in life at all. He was just stuck.
Yeah.
And, you know, that beautiful moment. And I was really watching this episode, and I was specifically paying attention to Avery Brooks and the way that he portrays Sisko. And he's just so good. And that little moment where he just, like, he says the idea of it was good to be home. And then he looks up and he gets this, like, great kind of quizzical look on his face, and he looks over at Jake and he's like, when did that happen? You know, and it's just, you know, I think that anybody who's moved anywhere and then they begin to refer to that place where they live as home, and it finally mm-hmm. does start to feel like home, that is an incredible feeling and an incredible moment. I mean, I used to refer to Texas as home, mm-hmm. even when living in the Northwest. And now, after almost 8 years of living here, this is home now. And so I think that's a really nice shift, because I think it also helps with the characterization of Sisko being willing to fight for this area of space, for being to fight for this space station and these people under his command. Like, this is his family. This is his home. Don't mess with him. And as we know, you don't mess with Sisko. Just ask Q.
That's right. Yeah, that's a great point, that for the story to play out, him feeling at home in the Bajor system is key. Of course, feeling at home on the station, but feeling at home in the Bajor system matters, because instead mm-hmm. of it being this assignment that he doesn't want, and he's going to do the best job he can because he's a Starfleet officer, but he'd rather be somewhere else. But suddenly, yeah, it becomes like defending your home front, and you really care about what happens around you here. And that's an important shift. And Jake as well. You know, I love the line in here where Jake says he's so glad that he's back and he can sleep in his own bed. You remember Jake really not wanting to come to the station at the opening of Emissary and complaining about mm-hmm. the bed, in fact. You know, I mean, sure, he has a better bed now than he did when he first arrived. But the point being that it's a major mind shift change for him. And I think children mm-hmm. are more adaptable than adults when it comes to a change of scenery like this. But still, the family element, I think, is really important. And
yes.
I was, you know, I've watched this episode 100 times at least. And still yesterday when I was watching, and I was just watching Ben and Jake on the screen having that conversation, and I was thinking, what a wonderful family setting they wrote for DS9, to have this father mm-hmm. and son together. It's just the two of them. They have each other. They've lost their mother, wife, and they've been through a lot in an environment that they would rather have not been in. And there's still so much love on the screen between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And also like adaptation, you know, to changes in life are there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I do. I think that's a fantastic point. And, you know, I think another thing that's great about the shift in tone here is that, and it's something that, you know, a lot of people talk about, like, oh, just start Deep Space Nine in season 4, you know, mm-hmm. but really the shift in tone was starting
yep.
at the end of season 2 into season 3. And I think this really just, what it does is just ramps everything up
yeah.
to, you know, level 11, you know. Yeah. We're really starting to put the characters through the fire here, because there's going to be a lot of things that happen in this episode to which are going to test some limits. And especially as we talk about the follow-up with part two, the same thing. And so just having the station feel more tense because of what they experienced at the end of season two and now into season three, not losing that, I think is fantastic. I mean, they're just, the writers here are doing a very good job of saying that, you know, Deep Space Nine is on the edge of the final frontier, is in the wilderness, and it that means, therefore, it is going to be more dangerous. My wife and I were watching 1883, which is a fantastic show about people on the Oregon Trail, and just how dangerous it is to be far away from everyone else, and, you know, you have only yourselves there. And I think season two's ender, and then season three's beginning, I think really set up a feeling of what maybe we come to know as the, like, Deep Space Nine milieu.
Yeah.
You know, that will permeate the rest of the series.
Yeah. Yeah. Because even me as a Niner, as the co-host of this show, as someone who's very steeped in DS9 lore, even I sometimes mentally think about season four as being where everything really kicks in. And maybe it's true that that's where it really kicks in, because if you think about the beginning of how the Way of the Warrior opens, which we discussed, you know, what, maybe six episodes back or so here. But it is very striking whenever you go back and rewatch The Search to realize how this really is the turning point. And maybe the Jem'Hadar, like you said, at the end of season two, is really the turning point in the tone of the show there. Because, you know, one thing that we often talk about with DS9 is that sense of family. And when we talk about the war, people think of DS9 as, oh, it's that Star Trek show with the war. And you and I say, well, the war is a backdrop, but the show is not about the war. Mm-hmm. The show is about how the war impacts the people and their relationships with one another. And yep. I think up until this point, that component of the show was not quite there yet. The feeling of family, of camaraderie amongst the crew that's necessary to tell the story that we get later. And we see that coming together in this episode. And we'll continue to see it come together. And it's not just Jake and Ben, for example. It's even Quark, the way Quark gets involved in things in this episode. And of course, there's the important element that we'll talk about a little bit later, Odo himself finally setting out and finding his people. But if you look at the interactions between Odo and Kira, for example, many characters coming together in a closer way, starting here, than we saw before, that builds and builds that environment that allows the war story to impact them in ways that we can connect with a lot more than if we were just watching some military organization or even a group of scientists who were trying to function while a war was raging around them.
Yeah. No, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, I think one of the other interesting things about this, too, is, you know, we mentioned T'Rol and, you know, we get the introduction of Eddington, and it's very short and we don't really spend a ton of time with him in this episode. But, you know, he's the impetus for Odo's actions as in many ways, and his reaction is very pronounced. But, you know, this is going to be a character which is going to be very important for the rest of the series. And, you know, I think what I love about it is that it does create all of this frustration in Odo, so that when we get to the end of the episode, it makes so much sense as to why he might make the decision that he does. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that is great. I mean, and so the writers in this episode, I think, do a very good job of that. You know, nothing is by mistake here, especially the introduction of Eddington. And even though he's in the episode for all of like 2 minutes, he's actually a big part of the reason why a major storyline actually happens, which is very good writing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we'll have to wait to part two for Eddington to make a total ass of himself.
Right? Yes, yes.
He does a great job, I have to say, of Kenneth Marshall does a great job of playing a truly arrogant Starfleet officer in the second part. Although there may be reasons for that, which we'll talk about when we get to part two. But yeah, the introduction of these characters, of course, T'Rul didn't offer enough for her to be a recurring character, which was the original concept that she would be around. Whereas Eddington did, but I think Eddington, looking ahead through the series, I think he's an example of how the DS9 writers can take an idea, put it into the show. It doesn't quite work the way they thought it might, but then later they pull that thread and use it in another way, because he was intended to be someone, because you remember Colm Meaney, was a popular movie actor. He was a active movie actor. And so sometimes he would have to go off and shoot a movie. He might not be available right when they needed him. And so the idea was, well, okay, we'll have Eddington when O'Brien can't be around because Colm is shooting a movie. And then there was also this idea that, well, maybe Eddington is a Dominion infiltrator. Wouldn't that be a twist? But what they ended up doing with him is having him be someone who's sympathetic to the Maquis, and have this conflict with Sisko in a few episodes, key episodes, which wasn't the original vision of the character, but by setting him up here in the search, they've given themselves something to play with later on. So for that reason, in particular, I think he's a nice addition to the show in this episode, but definitely as the catalyst for Odo's story. I think, tell me how you feel about this. So, of course, you could write it simply that Odo gets a clue about people in the Gamma Quadrant and he sets off to try to find his people. That would work. But having some catalyst to like push him out the door, like make him go and look for something else, to feel that motivation to not be as comfortable where he is, but to try to seek out something else. Does that work better for you as a story?
What I love about what they choose to do with Odo is the fact that, you know, they create this disconnect between him and everybody he's started to get to know. And what I think is great about it is, you know, one, Odo takes it as it being about him being the shapeshifter.
Right.
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 And really, it has nothing to do with that. You know, it comes down to the fact that he is not willing to be a team player, which is what hurts his relationship with Starfleet, which is what hurts his relationship with being, you know, here on Deep Space Nine, and you know, being the chief of security in a Starfleet, you know, they're the ones running the show here. The Bajorans asked them to come in and to run their station for them, and in doing that, they have specific ways of doing things and certain rules. And because he's not willing to play by them and wants to do things his way, that's what actually puts him on the outs with them. And I love the way that they just play with all of these ideas for him to really create this kind of internal storm. Like, I can't think of any other way to put it, like this internal storm in him. And then to go into the Gamma Quadrant and then find himself pulled by something that he cannot understand, I think is a great way to build into his story so that, you know, by the time that we do get to the reveal at the end, it makes so much sense. It makes it so shocking. And it also gives us this feeling of like, what in the heck is Odo going to do? Mm-hmm. And we really don't have a strong feeling of, because the whole in show so far has been about Odo feeling out of it, not feeling like he fits in anywhere. And in all intents and purposes, we understand why that's the case, because he doesn't. He is completely different than the rest of the people here. And now he's found his quote unquote people, and who will he choose? And I think they just do a great job of really setting up the storyline here in a way that's much more interesting and leaves you questioning as to what Odo will choose, because I don't think that you feel comfortable with what Odo is going to choose here. I really don't. And so I really appreciate, I think they did a great job with the writing here. And I think it just adds so many layers to this character, right? When we find out, like, oh my gosh, well, that stinks. He's actually one of the enemy, and we never knew it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, or quote unquote, the enemy,
yeah.
You know,
but so that's an interesting
I think
twist.
That's fantastic.
But that's an interesting twist, because we find out that he's one of the enemy, but yet we know that he's different from them. So,
right.
You know, it's not like, oh, he's one of the enemy and he has been spying on us, or he has infiltrated us, or anything mm-hmm. like that. So, you know, the story is going to go somewhere else with him. And that makes it interesting. What did you think about his decision to take Kira with him to this rogue planet after the Defiant was, I think specifically because it's Kira that's with him, as opposed to it being someone else from the crew who happened to be with him. She's telling him that it's, you know, the mission comes first. We should have gone back to the Defiant. We mm-hmm. needed to help them. But instead, he wants to go and check out this planet that he had identified on the star chart. And he's taken her with him. And even as she tells him that the mission comes first, he doesn't see it mm-hmm. that way. No, we're going to go here. But the two of them together, him taking her, I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, I one of the things I love about it is just how realistic it is to their relationship. I mean, you know, Kira is the one person I think that Odo trusts completely. And, you know, obviously, too, I think what's great about the writing here on the story is the way in which she went to bat for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that makes a lot of sense then as to why he trusts her and he would work to save her. And I think, too, you know, it's one of those things that when you look in retrospect, you can also see the way in which he feels about her, right? Which is more than just friends. And that's something we won't, you know, find out till obviously much later. But I think it works that that's the case. And so, I really like the fact that they put them in this position, because the other thing that I think is great about it is how uncomfortable this is going to make Kira,
mm-hmm.
because she wants to be there for her friend, but for her, I mean, and everybody else, this is a dangerous situation. This is the, you know, enemy, right? That we're trying to find a way to make friends with, but we have no idea if they actually want to be friends, and that's terrifying. So I think they do a great job of bringing her along in this episode and having them face this together, I think makes the most sense.
Yeah. Well, and like you said, in retrospect, it's a great moment, because if you know what comes mm-hmm. later for the two characters, then it makes a whole lot of sense. And of course, you know, they tie back to it essentially at the end of the series when they're back there at the Great Link.
Yes.
Well, and one other thing about Odo finding his people and us learning who the Dominion is, which of course we'll find out for sure in the second part of this discussion, but all those breadcrumbs that were being laid in season two, I like that those finally pay off here in this story.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you there. And this is one of the things that obviously Deep Space Nine became known for, which is this, we are going to use story elements. I mean, the fact that we go all the way back to season one and the Tula Berry wine episode, which, you know, I don't think any was anybody's favorite, right? But we're going to use that and harken back to that because it actually helps further our storyline. And that's one of the things I think that, again, makes for great writing. And something like the Clone Wars or Star Wars Rebels was actually really good at this idea, which was to take story elements to which people complain about and then make them mean something in a way to which you're like, you have to reevaluate that earlier story. And that just is incredible when in a sense of that's what good writing is. Yeah. You know, you want to try and redeem as much of your storylines as possible. And I think they do a great job here by utilizing everything to their benefit to create something really interesting. This is great because I think everybody at this point in the show, you just lean into your television because you're interested. You sense that this is different, right? And I think, yeah, it doesn't really take till season four. It's starting here.
Yeah. Well, creatively, there are some shifts here as well. Now, one of them, which DS9 is not known for, is Dax's hair. And it might seem like a silly topic for us to bring up here, but I remember watching it the first time and like, what did they do to her hair? And then, you know, she goes back to being the Jadzia that we knew before. What I found interesting was that it was almost like there was this feeling of like, we need to have more visual design to the character or something, like as if there were something missing. And so we've got to do something with her hair instead of letting her just have her previous normal hair. So that's one of the things. And then also Odo's makeup changes in this episode as well to one that Renee was more comfortable with. And I don't know how many people really pay attention to that unless it's pointed out to you, because I think they do it maybe because the story is so strong, you don't pay attention to these elements. But anyway, what do you have any thoughts on?
Well, they give him a belt.
Yeah,
for
and that's
his uniform.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things. But as far as those types of creative elements go, did anything else stand out to you? Have any thoughts on those?
So, you know, I have no problem with them, you know, trying to do those type of things. And in all honesty, I think it makes more sense. You know, the idea that Jadzia would have the exact same hairdo for like 6 years is kind of ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, I understand now, you know, I'll put it this way. My wife was in the military. She was in the Army and pretty much had the same hairstyle every single day because it was easy. And because, you know, it got it out of the way. And so actually, in some ways, that does make sense.
Yeah.
But, you know, I feel like in Starfleet, they're on space stations, they're on starships. And I think having some more variety, you know, would be great. You know, and in many ways, Star Trek does fall into this thing where everything looks the same all the time and characters don't really change much. But, you know, I mean, everybody gets a haircut. Women will change the color of their hair or the length of their hair. Mm-hmm. You know, like all of these things happen, right? And so in real life and in some ways, this just kind of, I thought, was a nice reference to the idea that, like, yeah, you know, you just get tired of the same thing and you do something different. And of course, we'll never see this hairstyle again, because if I remember correctly, it was such a pain in the butt for them to do for her. Yeah. And was so hard to keep looking nice.
Right.
They never did it again.
Yeah.
So,
well, that's sort of the in-universe thing about it for me as well. As my thought is that, yeah, especially women like to change their hairstyles, even from day to day, do something different with their hair. You know, I don't do that because I don't have enough hair to do anything like that myself. But it makes perfect sense, right, that they would do something like that. So in that respect, I thought it felt real and natural and normal. It was the nature of the hairstyle, apart from what the makeup artists had to go through to keep her hair like that. I'm thinking of Jadzia taking the time to do that and keeping her hair like that while she's on duty. It felt like a kind of extreme. It felt like something that would take a lot of work, and that didn't feel like her character to me in the situation. So, but anyway, it's a minor point. It's just one that really stands out because it is a major visual shift, and then it goes away. And so it felt like creatively there was a feeling of like, hey, we got to do something different here. And let's try it. Let's see how it works. But anyway.
Well, and that it will be something that we will kind of see throughout the series, in the sense that, you know, the characters are going to have different looks. I mean, even Sisko will get a different look in season 4, and we'll have a different look for Kira in some seasons, you know. Yep. So, you know, which I think is nice, because it does show, like, yeah, people don't just keep the exact same things for, you know, 7, 10, however many years. We all get older. We all experiment with different things. I mean, so, yeah, I think it works. And it just, I think it does a great job of reminding us that these are human, quote unquote, human beings, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, even if they're aliens, they're people that have lives and everything. So, yeah, I it was funny because, yeah, the hairstyle was so pronounced and didn't seem quite practical for the character.
Right.
But, you know, Terry looks great. So.
Yeah, of course. Another visual thing that I think we should note is the battle between the Defiant and the Jem'Hadar, because when you watch it today, especially if you're younger and you weren't, like, you grew up watching TV shows in the age of CGI where you have cinema quality special effects in every episode, you might take it for granted, but again, I was watching this yesterday and thinking that at the time that this aired, that battle was really impressive for that to be on weekly television. Because, again, it's not CGI. These are practical effects. And it's the kind of excitement that you are accustomed to in films, but you didn't get so often on television, because it takes time and money to put something like that together. And, you know, that's a case where I feel like DS9 really pushed the envelope in ramping up the excitement level of what's happening in space, and not just simply what's happening on a ship, as was so often the case on The Next Generation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, other than possibly the Enterprise A in Star Trek VI that takes this beating.
It's a tough
and,
little ship,
you know,
here.
Still. Yeah, I know. It's functioning in any way, shape, or form. And so I think one of the things that they really do in this battle, they accentuate the toughness of the ship. They accentuate how dangerous this ship is. But I mean, they're outgunned, and they seem to have a smaller crew on board anyway. And so they're not able to get out of it. But it does, I think, for the time, it definitely looked good. And this is the type of thing that Deep Space Nine will start to do more of, and really push some technological boundaries, which is phenomenal. So, yeah, it really is. It's something that we don't think about today, but they were doing things that took a lot of time, you know? And yes, I know CGI work and VFX, it can take a lot of time as well, but not the same, I think, time intensive and then comping all this together in the way right. that they used to have to as well. I mean, it's just, it was a laborious process, so.
Right. Yeah, CGI takes time. It does take money. You can do things that are far more realistic, and you can do those things much more easily than you could with the practical process that they were using back then. And so you're able to create much more realism today and do things on a small screen that would have been limited to the big screen in the past. All right. Well, that battle is in Act 5, and it's very near the end of the first part. And I've been trying very hard today to limit my discussion to what happens in the first part of the story, knowing the whole story. And so I'm looking forward to our next episode, Matthew, when we talk about that second half, because I like the way that this story is split, where in part one, we get the shift in tone for the series. We get the family set up for the crew. Mm-hmm. We set Odo on this journey to find himself. We have a lot of setup that we're going to pay off in the second part, where we ramp up the mm-hmm. intrigue a bit more and really set the series story in motion more with the Dominion. So we will talk about that next time. Do you have any final thoughts on the first part?
I'd just say, you know, this continues to be just a good episode. And I think intriguing, you know, it was one of those things where, yeah, I know what's coming up next, right? But I'm still excited to watch the second part and to get into it. So, yeah, I love it. I really do. And I think it's it speaks to the quality of the writing of the show, and it speaks to the way in which these creators were already starting to think in a long term thought process of. You know, where they could plant things, where they could use things, and how that might play out. So, yeah, it's great. It's really great.
Yeah, for me, what I love about it is that it does signal a shift in the series, but it isn't one of those cases where someone wrote a show for a couple of seasons and decided that they needed to go in another direction with it, and then they come along with a new season where they've kind of overhauled the show. Because you see that happen sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's a case of they really built on the first two seasons, and some things worked well, some things didn't work as well in those first two seasons, but they built this foundation and then they naturally evolved it at this point. And it feels like, just like the arrival of the Defiant, feels like a natural continuation of the end of season two. And that reminds me, one other thing that I love, the episode opens with a recap of previously on Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and then we get the voiceover, and now the continuation. And what I like about that is that it really is indicative of the series to come, where we are going to have a continuation all the way through to the end of this series, rather than, here's a story, and we've got one more part of that story to tell you before we move on to something else. Mm-hmm. It's like we're building something that we're going to slowly unravel over the next 4 years or 5 years here.
Yep, 100%.
Yeah. All right. Well, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on the search, on the start of DS9 Season 3, how the show evolved. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to the Babel Conference on Facebook. That's our closed listeners group. If you're already a member, you know how it works. But if you're not, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it should come right on up. If not, type the whole name, the Babel Conference. It is a closed group, so please answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. We'll put a post for this episode of The Orb there, and you can share your thoughts with us and fellow listeners, and extend the discussion beyond the podcast. If you'd like to send us email, you can do that by going to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there, choose to send to a show, and choose the orb. And that'll come to Matthew and me by email. And of course, you can find us in social media. Our username on Twitter, Instagram, and everywhere is TrekFM. All right, Matthew, when you're not figuring out the perfect food pairing for that bottle of Tula Berry wine that you got from Cork, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero, all those type of places. Of course, here on the network, we don't just talk Star Trek. We talk all sorts of fandoms over on the 602 Club. So you can find me in that feed. We've got some bonus shows in that same feed as well. So it's a great place to check out. So we talk Star Wars and Harry Potter. And I mean, just it's endless what we're talking over there. So I hope you'll see what we've got going on there. You can also find me doing Warp 5 Literary Treks in the Artificial Tango. Warp 5, Chris, you and I have been celebrating 20 years of Star Trek Enterprise as we talk about each episode of that series. We finished season 1 and we'll be going on to season 2 soon, so I hope everybody will enjoy that. And of course, Literary Treks is about the books and the comics of Star Trek. And then the Artificial Tango is where we're dancing our way through Star Trek Picard Season 2, which has been great so far. And then you can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network. I've got a finished show there called Outpost I did with Drea Kaufman. It was to talk about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series one chapter at a time. And then John Mills and I are talking Star Wars over on Aggressive Negotiations. But Chris, when you're not trying to figure out what that new hairstyle should be for your on-duty look, where can people find you?
Yeah, I'm working on that. I'm working on a really elaborate hairstyle that I have only when we podcast. I'm going to get up and fix it up just for our recordings. But when I'm not doing that, you can find me, as you mentioned, talking Enterprise with you on Warp 5, Picard on the Artificial Tango. I also have Interphase, a Star Trek Universe podcast, and Larry Nemechek and I do the Ready Room from time to time. And I'm also busy with other things behind the scenes here on the network. You can also find me doing my usual business writing, magazine stuff, all that kind of stuff. So whatever you'd like to chat with me about, I'd love to hear from you. I'm on Twitter, where my username is C Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. That's my username everywhere in social media, but Twitter is where I'm most active, and I would love to chat with you. If you would like to help us keep the Orb and the 602 Club and the Artificial Tango and all that other stuff we're doing going, we could definitely use your help and your support. If you'd like to find out how to get involved in the network and how to support what we're doing, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to find out how. It takes a great deal of money to operate the network and get these shows out to you, and we could definitely use your help. And we want to send a huge thank you to everyone who's supporting us right now. We would not be here without you. So thank you very, very much. Well, Matthew, I am going to just head down to that rogue planet and see what's happening as I prepare for our next discussion, where we're going to talk part 2 of the search.
Well, Chris, I feel like that is a great idea. And to everyone else, thank you so much for listening. And we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.